Tuesday, May 27th. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. On the show today, Cherry?
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
Well, yesterday was Memorial Day. It kicked off the season at area beaches. This means the Jersey Shore was open for business.
And we're having a show today celebrating that, right?
We kind of. Because in recent decades, the shore has been under threat due to climate change. And the real cost of coastal living is becoming harder to ignore. Sea levels are rising, extreme weather is intensifying, and the insurance market is responding. They are tightening their belts as more New Jersey homes are at risk of repeated flooding, even under best case climate scenarios. Some insurers are even pulling out of the market. So today we're going to ask, how much should taxpayers spend to protect and rebuild coastal communities? Should we adapt and continue investments, or at some point, will we simply need to retreat? We have a great panel of two guests coming in. We're also going to have a call out. We're going to hopefully hear from you, our listeners, as well. Our question of the day, should taxpayer money go to rebuilding and protecting the shore? And I have a follow-up for that. Do you have a line in the sand where you would say, oh, no, it's time to stop? You can call us.
Pun intended?
What?
Line in the sand?
Yeah, I had to throw that
in. I just wasn't sure. You did it with such a straight face. Yeah.
Of course.
Line in the sand.
Our line in the sand, man. Call us, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your comments in the chat.
All right. Trio of local news stories, Cherry. And let's start with an incident in the Lemon Hill section of Fairmount Park that has shaken the entire city as we woke up this morning. I'll leave that one for you.
Yeah, Monday night, Memorial Day ended with two people dead and 11 wounded in a mass shooting in the Lemon Hill section of Fairmount Park. Philadelphia police believe the rapid fire violence came from a modified weapon that had the capability to shoot 17 rounds in under 2 seconds. I want you to take a listen to Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker, who spoke at a press conference less than an hour ago.
In a place and space where families gather, people in neighborhoods gather, we will not be held hostage by anyone who decides that they want to get assault-like, war-like weaponry.
Yeah, I mean, she was very upset, as were members of the police department and the city's public safety office as well. I mean, police have identified the two adult victims as 23-year-old Amaya Devlin, a woman, and 21-year-old Mikhail Bowers, a young man. The wounded, by the way, range in age from 15 years old to 27 years old, and no one right now is in custody. Police say the gunfire erupted just before 10:30 p.m. on Lemon Hill Drive. Bethel says hours before that, around 8 o'clock, they got calls to 911 about the crowd, but there were so many cars, so many large groups, so many young people, hundreds, that made it hard to break that crowd up. And police have been all over the city, you know, managing crowds because people were out. The weather was gorgeous.
As they should be, and right? That's not the bad part.
No. Yeah. The bad part is somebody came in and did this. And you know, Avi, we were talking about this in our production meeting end of last week about the trending downward of shootings and homicides in the city. And then this happens.
Yeah. And look, I guess you would say the good news is that we're still down from where we were a year ago, and last year was a good year compared to the ones before it, but there has been a troubling uptick over the last month or so, and we certainly hope that that ebbs. But, you know, this shooting is heartbreaking for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the age of the victims. Mm-hmm. That's heartbreaking. And no matter where it happens, it would have been heartbreaking. But Lemon Hill is a place where people go to celebrate. It's a jewel of the city. It's actually the first part of Fairmount Park. Fairmount Park started with the Lemon Hill Estate. And so it's symbolically important as well. And so it is very hard to digest that news this morning.
And I will say the mayor said we are not going back to the old stats. You talked about the decrease and we're still lower than we have been in years prior, but she doesn't want to go back. And so PPD, they're planning to step up protocols for crowd control and prevention. And they call this an unplanned crowd. So they're going to be stepping that up. They're also on the lookout for possible retaliatory violence. But, you know, there were so many questions that came in my mind because the shooting happened at 10:30. The parks typically close at dusk.
Right.
And hundreds of people were still out there a couple of hours later. So just so many questions. But, you know, tragedy when you have two people in their early 20s losing their lives and almost a dozen others injured.
Moving now to a story about food safety in Delaware County. We got this piece from The Inquirer. Delco towns and restaurants, Cherry, are revolting against the county's efforts to do food safety inspections. So here's the backstory. Delaware County did not have a county health department until just a few years ago. They got the new department now, and they want to do health inspections at restaurants. That sounds about right. But 13 townships have sued the county to stop them from doing the restaurant inspections. These local inspectors, these township inspectors say, we can do the job better. We know the restaurants better. We can work with them to resolve any issues. Now, these towns do want the county to do some health stuff, for instance, like spraying for mosquitoes. They just don't want the county to do any restaurant stuff. And they've gone to court to prevent this from happening. And indeed, so far, they have largely been successful. Now, Delaware County says they need to have a countywide program if they want to, you know, trace foodborne illness outbreaks. They also think that they're doing a good job in uncovering more violations that apparently were not being picked up. But that is the state of play when it comes to restaurant health inspections in Delaware County. Big government versus little government, all sorts of intrigue. Your brow is furrowed. What do you think, Cherry?
Yeah, because, you know, it raises a lot of questions. It's another story that raises a lot of questions for us.
They all do, Cherry. They all do.
Like, why wouldn't you want the health, you know, department to come check restaurants in your township?
Yeah, why wouldn't you want that?
I don't know. And I will say they had an expert.
Why wouldn't you want that? Let me repeat that one more time. Why wouldn't you want that?
Questions.
I mean, well, maybe I'll ask the people who are eating at those restaurants. Why wouldn't you want that?
Yeah. Yeah. They just might, you know. And the other thing is, I will say they had an expert in this Inquirer article who said sometimes it's an issue of trust. You know, there's a lot of distrust of big government and that maybe the health department should roll out their expanded services slowly so people can trust them more. I don't know what you think about that. A lot of questions.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions.
I'll be with the question face.
Yeah, it seems like a very minor intrusion in terms of big government intrusions, just providing the service of health inspections. So the reaction seems strong to me, rather strong.
Yeah. Like, why would you want to stop it?
I eat most of my meals in Philadelphia, and I think I might continue to do that, Cherry.
Yeah.
For the time being, as this all plays out.
Yeah, as Delco works it out. All right.
As it all plays out. All right. Third story before we get to our big topic today. There was an amusing thread that I found this morning on the Philadelphia subreddit. And it was just people listing their least favorite highway billboards.
That's such a Philly thread, by the way.
In Philadelphia. Basically, people were complaining. And the example given to kick off the thread, this was the billboard that really annoyed the original poster, was a billboard on, I think it's on 95, for Mike's Mayonnaise. And the billboard says, Mayo Adrian.
I see that every day going home. Yeah. And I'm like,
it's a Rocky reference.
I didn't know how to say it, though. How would you say that?
How I just said it. Mayo Adrian.
Oh, okay.
What did you think the reference was?
I didn't know what it was referenced, but I didn't know how that.
Yo Adrian.
That's Yo Adrian. Referenced. Okay.
Got it. It's a Rocky
I'm
thing.
Slow.
So anyway, got us thinking. And then people below that just posted all their least favorite billboards in the Philly area. And I am just curious, first of all, what you think distinguishes an effective billboard from an annoying billboard.
I will say that Mayo Adrian definitely made me think, because I didn't know how to say that. I was like, I don't understand that. But I also think an effective billboard is one that is very memorable.
Okay.
But I also think you shouldn't have too many, because when I see the same billboard right. over and over and over again, that is very annoying.
There's a level of saturation where it doesn't yes. matter how good the billboard is. You just don't want to see that billboard
anymore. Not anymore.
Okay, so give me your least favorite Philly billboards.
My least favorite are all the lawyer billboards, and I can yeah. name a few.
Okay. Well, who are the worst offenders? Who are you taking
Top
to court?
Dog law. Top dog law with the cell phone and a bag of money.
Get it out. Get it out.
But I do remember it, though. I do remember it. How about you?
Top dog. Go. What are they? Go to the doghouse. Get out of here. I don't like the John Morgan ones, obviously.
Oh,
J-A-W-N. Yeah. That's very, very patronizing. There's this one, like, Bill, I guess they make handbags. I don't know what the company is, but it says it's a picture of a handbag and it says your girl wants me bad.
Oh.
And I'm like, I don't need like a pornographic handbag billboard.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just show me the handbag and
yeah,
move it along.
That was marketed to you to buy a handbag for your boo.
Move it along. Move it along. Any good ones? Do you like any of them?
I do like the I hate Steven Singer billboards. And the reason why I like
those are everywhere. That's saturation.
I know, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't know that was a jewelry place. And they bugged me so much that I, one day in traffic, looked it up.
I would say my favorite ones are...
I'll say that's an effective one. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Your favorite.
I think in the category of favorite, I really like I don't really like, but at least I tolerate the ones where it just tells you what's going to be playing at like the Borgata.
Yeah.
Because that's information I could use.
Yeah,
you know,
that is.
Engelbert Humperdinck's going to be at the Borgata. Great. If I like Engelbert Humperdinck, cool. If I don't, then, you know, I move on with my life.
You pulled that one out. There you go.
Anyway, speaking of the Jersey Shore, we'll be talking about it on the other side of this break on Studio 2. Stick with us for more Engelbert Humperdinck references.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The sea level off of New Jersey's coast is rising. That much we know. The question is what we will do in response. There are thousands of people, homes, and businesses clustered along the Jersey shore. Abandoning them seems inconceivable.
But protecting them from the rising tide seems impossible. Rebuilding them after each flood feels Sisyphean, and then there is the task of insuring them. Will private companies continue to take on that risk? And if they won't, what then?
We'll ask our experts. With us in studio is Benjamin Collier, Associate Professor of Risk Management and Insurance at Temple University's Fox School of Business. Ben, welcome to Studio 2. And we also have Gilbert Gall, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of The Geography of Risk. Gil, thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
And our question for you at home or in the car or at the beach this hour, should taxpayer money go to rebuilding and protecting the shore? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, or if you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the YouTube chat.
And so, Gil, I wanted to start with you because you've been covering this topic for quite some time, and you've called coastal development in flood zones a form of, quote, subsidized delusion. And so I want you to kind of explain to us what made you want to dig into this issue so deeply, and what did you see that you think others were sort of ignoring?
Right. So I've been going to the beach forever. Pretty much grew up at the beach, and I've spent a large part of my life there. Love the coast. I'm 74 now. I still keep going. I still surf at Long Beach Island on the Jersey Shore and go to the Outer Banks every year. I have been for 40 years. So I've watched personally what's happened to the modern coasts. And it became alarming to me when the development grew to such a level that we seemed to be losing the authenticity of going to the beach and why we were going there. Nature was being pushed to the background. I mean, in many places, it's to the point where when you drive down the ocean beach, you can no longer see the ocean, let alone the beach. because it's just a wall of development. New Jersey is just a great example of this. I mean, it's a place where the last time I looked, and now that's about 5 or 6 years ago, there were about $100 billion worth of property along 45 or 46 oceanfront communities. Mm. Sandy comes along in 2012, wrecks the backsides of these barrier islands, does some damage on the front end, but largely along the backside as long as the bayfront places. And what happens after Sandy is that we come back and we rebuild and rebuild. And it's even, there's even more property now along these stretches at risk than there was before.
Yeah. Let's dive into the economics mm-hmm. of development down the shore, Gil. So obviously there's a lot of demand to yep. live in these areas, and that explains on some level why there's so much building and why there's so much expensive building down the shore. But is that it? Like, what explains the sort of economic ecosystem of the shore and why it just keeps seeming to spiral more and more and more and more and more expensive?
Right. So, I mean, tourism isn't a new thing, right? It's yeah. been around for quite a long time. And it's unsurprising that these beautiful beaches would develop. A lot of the development, the early development, occurred in a time frame when people weren't thinking at all about risk. Mm. I would argue, and Ben and I were talking about this earlier, that even today, when you go and interview mayors in many oceanfront communities, and I've interviewed dozens and dozens of them over the years, what's really surprising to me is how little thought is given to what's coming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's coming. So there's no long-term thought. The thought is all short-term. That goes back to your question, because the economics are all driven by short-term issues. I mean, mm-hmm. if you have one of these towns, whether you're talking about a Long Beach Township, which is a lovely, largish community on Long Beach Island, or Harvey Cedars, or one of these other places, they have every incentive to development. There's no incentive to disinvestment or to after a storm to get smaller. And that's simply because of the amount of revenue that they take in from all this development. Now, we can come back to later if you want to. I can walk you through the economics of what's happening with housing sizes and why we no longer see cottages at the beach. What we see are mega mansions, mini hotels.
I understand why the towns want it. Mm-hmm. I guess the question is, why do the developers keep building it, and why do the people keep buying it?
Because they make money.
Yeah.
I mean, they make lots of money. People buy it because, again, going back, they're not thinking about what's coming. They're not thinking about the next Sandy. They're not thinking about the next 1962 nor'easter that wrecked Long Beach Island. They're thinking about, well, you know, we're going to rent this place out. If we rent it out for 28 weeks at such and such a price, you know, we can net after expenses anywhere between 80 and 100 grand a year.
Mm-hmm.
We can pay off our house after 10 years because of the
I don't care if a storm comes along.
Oh, of course they care. They don't want a storm to come along, but they're not thinking about it.
And I want to ask you that, because why I don't get that part, why they're not thinking about it, because we've
because
seen the
they
photos.
Haven't experienced it.
But we've seen the Sandy wasn't
Sandy,
so
yeah.
long ago. I mean, we've seen the photos, right? There were streets flooded, wrecked homes. I mean, multi-million-dollar homes devastated. And
the next summer, you're back on the beach. You're enjoying the beach. You're not thinking about all that damage from Sandy. Your insurer has probably paid for a large amount of the cost of rebuilding. Federal subsidies, everything from rebuilding the roads to replacing the streetlights to dumping sand on your beach that was wiped away in the storm.
Well, that's the part I think we're trying to get to is that, like, the risk that you would think about the risk if you had lived through Sandy and then your community had been abandoned, or the road quality had deteriorated, or the quality of the electrical grid was shot.
Right.
But that's not what happens.
Right.
And that's because of government spending, more or less.
In part because of government spending. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
And Ben, we want to bring you into this conversation, because we're hearing all the beauty and the short-sightedness of many people who invest on the shore. But I want you to kind of explain, because I don't think most people know. I know I do not know how insurance works, who pays for all this stuff. So could you sort of give us a framework of how insurance works to help subsidize some of the damage that continuously happens along the coast.
Great. So the core point on insurance is we can take a risk that you may or may not face, and we can spread the financial cost of that risk. So if there's a bunch of people that are all exposed to health shocks, some of us will get sick this year, some of us get bad illnesses, and other people won't, and we can spread those risks. Same kind of thing with property risks, in that you may have a fire at your house this year, I may not, we don't know ahead of time, so we're buying insurance to spread that risk. Same thing with home insurance, where we're spreading those risks there. And then people often don't know that flood insurance is a different product than homeowners insurance, right, and it requires a separate contract. I'll say a minute about homeowners insurance and then talk about flood for a minute. So insurers are looking out the window just like us, and they're seeing Sandy, and they're seeing the LA wildfires and so on, and recognizing that these risks seem like they're increasing.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Right? And climate science is saying this is going to get worse. It's not going to get better. But those scientists aren't able to say precisely how bad this risk has changed since the past and how bad it's going to be in the future. So insurers are in this spot where they have to estimate what's the risk at your house, at your Jersey Shore house today. How much has it changed since the past? It's a really difficult question to answer, and right, they have some models for that. But often, you know, if they're seeing it's really bad this past year, they're going to think this risk must be worse than we thought in the past, and they're going to raise prices, and that leads to large price changes in some cases. We're seeing insurance prices go up in a number of places, not only in the coastline, in the Midwest too, by 20% one year to the next, the last few years, sometimes more. Insurers saying they're not going to provide insurance to people who've been buying insurance from them for years, and maybe even have never had a claim, but they're in a risky place. So we're seeing big changes in the insurance market because insurers are worried they're going to have a Superstorm Sandy or some other event that cuts into years and years worth of profits, you know, that they would have, that they've been spending to protect these homeowners, and then all that can be wiped out, you know, all the revenues that they have brought in over several years.
And my follow-up to you, Ben, is this. I mean, where is the line for insurers? Like, what conditions exist where an insurer says, you know what, we're pulling out of this market, it's not worth it to us, sorry, mm-hmm, homeowners?
Yeah, I think it's different by insurer, and it's also different by state. Some states put a lot of limits on how much insurers can raise prices. And so California is a notable example on this. Insurers can only raise prices so much there. And what many have done is said, look, all the wildfire risk here, we'd rather just not participate in this market if we can't charge a higher price. So you have different approaches by different state level regulators to determine how much you can change prices there. If there's more pricing caps, then more insurers are going to leave the market.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Gil was just talking about the fact that there's a lot of short-term thinking, maybe delusional thinking, when it comes to development down the shore.
Yeah.
But the whole point of insurers is they're supposed to be doing the long-term risk, mm-hmm, thinking, right? Like, got actuarial spreadsheets, and they're, yeah, looking at like how much this will cost us in 10, 15, 20 years. So why is the Jersey Shore insurable right now? And, yeah, and what would it take to actually change that?
So for a given house, yeah, if we look toward the future, we think the risks are going to go up over time. That means over time, your insurance prices have to go up too, because there's more risk in the future than there is today. So insurers may be willing to cover a house this year on an annual contract that they might not be willing to insure, or they might charge a much higher rate 10 years from now on that property. So homeowners bear that risk. Those property owners, if the costs of insuring that property go up over time, it's going to reduce their property values. It's going to be a bigger burden on their finances.
Gil, go ahead. Yeah.
We should talk a little bit about flood insurance,
because, yeah,
and talk a little bit about the politics of flood insurance,
yeah,
because if you look at recent history, what's happened after several major or catastrophic storms, including Sandy, is that FEMA, the folks who run NFIP, suggested or came in, not even suggested, came in and said, we want to raise the price of flood insurance, mm-hmm, to more accurately reflect the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened in the politics was, again, unsurprising, I suppose, is that the homeowners and politicians, local politicians, got involved and began a campaign to beat back those increases. And that's, in fact, what happened. So politically, it's extremely, mm-hmm, difficult to raise prices, well, especially for a public program like the, yeah, NFIP.
And that leads me to this bigger question, which, mm-hmm, is what would have to change the economics of developing down on the Jersey Shore to the point where it's not feasible anymore.
We're seeing it.
Well, but let me, can I just lay out a couple scenarios? One is that the government pulls out and says, we're not going to rebuild it after the next storm. That's probably not going to happen, right? This sort of unilateral action by the government. So then I start to think, what market forces could change and how much would they have to change for it to be impossible to keep building? So I'll put that to you, Gilgal.
So we have a bit of a case study going on right now in South Florida and also along the Gulf Coast of Florida, which was hit by Ian a couple of years ago in a devastating hurricane. And what you're seeing is, Ben was explaining earlier, is that insurers are beginning to decide, we're not going to insure here. We're not going to offer things.
Or, enough of them are making that decision simultaneously.
Yeah, it's become an issue. It's become difficult in some places to get insurance, and that's one of the places. So, I don't know if you agree with me on this, Ben, but I think that we're beginning to see what the future looks like through the financial signals that are coming through the insurance markets.
And so, when that happens, when you have a market where insurers retreat in mass, maybe we haven't gone down this timeline enough yet, but then what happens to the economics of that place?
Good question. The one part I worry about is a lot of these places are already so expensive, so costly that, look, no average person can buy a beach house these days. Mm-hmm. Just doesn't happen. Just the wealth becomes such an issue that it becomes a place, if it's left in place, it becomes a place where only the wealthy can afford to go to.
So on the point on what happens if your insurer walks away, you know, there may be other insurers that would offer you coverage. Most states, including New Jersey, have a state-run insurer of last resort.
Yeah.
And so you can still typically get insurance. This is important for mortgage markets, that people can have insurance. And in general, for society, that people have insurance in these situations.
So there's a government backstop, basically, in a place like New Jersey.
And I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Because what I don't understand here is the sort of the risk that taxpayers take versus the risk that insurers take.
Great.
What is that dividing line look like? And I want to walk through a series with you on this.
Yes.
What does that look like and how has that changed?
I think it's an important question, and sort of coming back to Avi's point earlier, in some of these communities, I'm not sure that the right answer is that they shouldn't rebuild. Like in some of these places, we love going to the shore. There's a value for that. Maybe we want to keep on paying to build houses there, even if it's costly to do that. So private insurers are in business to stay in business. They're going to earn a profit. And so they're thinking carefully about taking on that risk. They're going to pass on that cost to homeowners. The government steps in a couple of ways. One is with flood insurance, where it's historically charged rates that are too low relative to the risk that it takes on, and then taxpayers have to pay for that. Another piece of this is federal and state level spending when there's a big disaster to help people who are in a tough spot, but also to repair roads and bridges and utility lines and all that. So,
the public infrastructure
is, you know, often borne by a combination of federal and state.
And so,
funding.
Ben, I'm a visual person.
Sure.
So give me the pie. Like, what does it look like, the pie? Like, how much is it taxpayer dollars, meaning you, I, and our neighbors all pitching in versus insurance dollars versus something else? The individual homeowner, for example.
Yeah, I wish I had some internet here or something where we could look for a specific event, because I think it changes event by event, you know, in the sense of like with California with wildfires, there's much more insurance coverage than a flood event because people don't know they have to buy flood insurance, or they may know
separate
but they don't
home,
do
yeah.
it. Yeah, it's separate from home. And so for floods, those are the really costly events, and a big part of the ticket is the public spending.
So in a flood situation, many times the public is are the ones stepping up.
If you look at like the Sandy appropriations bill, that I don't know, 2/3 of it or something is for public spending to repair MTA or the Jersey Shore infrastructure and so on.
Yeah. I just want to read in some comments real quick, Gil, and I do have a question for you off of that. So Mary says insurance has gone up, but our deductible is higher too. Maura on YouTube says, I don't want to have taxpayers fund infrastructure for these massive vacation homes, but we should protect the year-round residents whose families have been there for generations. Mm-hmm. Keep those comments coming. Studio2@whyy.org. We're also on YouTube, and you can call 888-477-9499. So Gilgal, here's the way I'm thinking about it, having talked it through with you guys. At some point in time, the private insurers in vulnerable areas are going to retreat. Maybe that's today in South Florida. It's 20, 30, 50 years in New Jersey. the backstop's going to be us, the taxpayer, the government, whether through providing insurance or rebuilding after storms. And then at some point, we would all have to collectively decide whether we want to keep footing that bill to keep those communities viable. Is that the, do you think that's the basic story we're working through here over the course of the next few decades?
I do, to some degree, yes. Now, whether the government will continue to fund these kinds of activities, I think, is up for debate.
Right.
There's a movement. It's been very, very slow. But we're beginning to see a little bit more reluctance to pay for some of these things. I think the present administration has suggested increasing the amount of money that the states will have to contribute after disasters. And I think we'll begin to see more of that as we go along.
Yeah. I think we also, looking forward, the housing stock's not going to stay the same. We have to build differently, and we do need to build in different places than we did in the past. So we have a history of this, where if you go back 30, 40 years, houses on the Jersey Shore were not always on stilts, for example. Mm-hmm. We build differently than we did, and we're going to have to continue to do that. If you want to make a home more insurable, change the way that it's built. And that's very costly for existing properties, but moving forward, that's going to be more and more the norm. And there's a pressure from insurers to do that, to facilitate that adaptation. Mm.
So there's market forces acting on the construction and development industry to get them to build differently.
Yes.
Interesting.
And that I would want to bring in another guest who can probably shed some light on this very issue. Someone who is dealing with beach erosion and severe weather as part of his job. We have Tim Carney, mayor of Stone Harbor, New Jersey, and he's joining us now on the phone. Tim, you're on Studio 2. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, Avi and Cherry, thanks for having me.
Tim, I thought we'd ask you to tell us a little bit about Stone Harbor, you know, the size of the area and just, you know, how you all are dealing with threats to the area when it comes to climate change.
Yeah, well, our town is probably half the size of Avalon, our neighbor. We have 3,000 property owners and we have around 900 full-time residents. We're only about, 50 blocks long, but we've had our share of experiences around beach erosion and, sediment moving back and forth. In 21, we had a substantial loss of our beach, especially in our southern end. And over 7 months, the shoreline retreated 36 feet. So there was a significant amount of loss during those storms. And it's a never-ending sort of project we have to deal with. Beach replenishment, cost in millions of dollars, right? So we have to prepare for that.
Yeah. And one of the things that Gil was talking about, and Ben to some extent, was sort of like, homeowners and townships really thinking ahead, and even changing how they construct properties. Is that something you all are taking into account, and what changes have been made to sort of deal with this evolving change that is hitting the shoreline there?
Yeah. Well, FEMA after Sandy, played a big part in that, right? So, they mandated raising properties, whether you're building a new one or if you're renovating one, you have to raise it 10 feet. Stone Harbor Borough actually added an additional 2 feet. So what you see here, we're normally a two-story town, according to our building code, but now properties look like they're three stories, right? Because it's 12 feet above the floodplain.
So obviously that helps protect the individual house, right, if there's a flood and it's raised up. But that water still affects the roads. It still affects other parts of the infrastructure. Is the town doing anything to protect those types of things that can't be raised up but are still vitally important to the town's function?
Well, we are. And the first thing is that, we've got to start with the beaches, right? That's the reason everyone comes to our town. And so the beaches have to be safe and they have to have enough sand on them and they have to be accessible. So, we just finished a $30 million beach replenishment project where we partnered with Avalon, our neighbor. And the reason it was $30 million was finding that sand was difficult. Mm. There's an inlet between Stone Harbor and Wildwood. It's called the Hereford Inlet. And the feds, unfortunately, didn't allow us to dig that sand up and move it. Yeah. So instead of us sucking sand from 5 blocks away, we had to move that sand from 200 blocks away down in the Sea Isle area, which is another inlet called Townsend's Inlet. We've actually fought the federal DEP and won that case, so that now, moving forward, instead of spending $30 million on beach replenishment, it'll cost each town about, you know, $5 to $8 million.
Quick question as we wrap up, Tim. I mean, who's paying for all of this? Is this, like, what is, if you were to, I tried to do a pie here about where the money's coming from, but if you could explain to us who's footing the bill.
Yeah, well, I did hear your pie comment earlier. It's a combination of things, right? You use federal money to replenish the beaches. We actually take a real estate transfer tax out of every transaction in town. That goes into a bucket. You can only use that money to perform sand replenishment. Mm-hmm. We also get federal money. We also get state money as well.
Yeah. Well, that's Tim Carney, mayor of Stone Harbor, New Jersey. Thanks so much for taking some time out of your busy day, sir, to join us here on Studio 2.
Well, thanks for having me.
And keep those calls and comments coming, folks. 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. We're talking about the Jersey Shore and its economic future on Studio 2 on WHYY. Stay tuned.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about the cost to shore up the Jersey Shore, if it's worth it, and who is paying for it. Homeowners down the shore have seen their insurance rates rise because insurers are seeing the rising seas and superstorms on the horizon. So the question we're asking you, our listeners, is this. Should taxpayer money go to rebuilding and protecting the shore? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to drop your comments in the live chat.
With us here in Studio 2 is Ben Collier, Associate Professor of Risk Management and Insurance at Temple University's Fox School of Business, and Gil Gall, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and the author of The Geography of Risk.
Yes, and I want to read a couple comments. We have one on YouTube from David who says, coastal regions often support large populations, vital tourism economies, and critical infrastructure. Just as we invest in disaster relief or drought-stricken farming regions, it's fair to protect coastal homes and communities, especially if we're protecting more than just private residences. And we got an email from Slow Food who says sandbars, aka barrier islands, by their own nature are ever changing. Resilience efforts are too short-sighted because we're doing damage at an even faster exponential rate. Millionaires should fit the bill, not the masses.
I'm guessing foot the bill was what Slow Food bill. Was going for there. Yeah. But that goes right to my point, Gilgal, that you were raising earlier. As I gave you sort of the future scenarios and how they might play out, you said the upshot of it was basically only the rich will be able to build and rebuild at the beach. Mm-hmm. But at some point, even the rich, right? I don't know how they could continue to support that. And there are only so many rich people, and there are a lot of beaches. So isn't there a point past that where it just becomes straight up impossible for everybody?
I think they're a lot more rich than you imagine.
Okay.
When it comes to the coast, because really, I think it's virtually impossible unless you inherit a home and it passes down through generations.
Yeah.
Pick one of the original cottages and now maybe you've torn it down and rebuilt it. To buy a house at the beach these days, is incredibly expensive, probably $1 million on average just to get a starter home at the beach. Closer you get to the water, the more it's going to be. We're talking more $4, $5, $10 million.
Right.
I think those folks have enough money or wherewithal that they can continue at least for the next few decades.
The next few decades, yeah.
To pay, you know, for damage, to continue to live there. One point I want to make is that at many of these, in many of these shore communities, there's very little population there.
Right.
I mean, it was always thought that my generation, you know, we would all retire to the beach and we'd be living at the beach. Well, we can't afford to retire to the beach and live at the beach, for one thing, but we didn't do that. So if you look at a place like Long Beach Island, excepting for COVID, when people from the cities and whatnot flew to the to the beaches to hide out, they're largely just investment communities.
But I guess there's enough people still, and I don't know how much longer this will be the case. There's enough people that you could still have a few restaurants, a liquor store, a fire department, the things that make a community, right? Like at some point, you would think there's just not enough people who can pay that premium to support that community, to make it a real community, a real place to live. There has to be a breaking point. Am I wrong?
I don't know that you're wrong. Ben will take this. Yeah. I'm not sure what that breaking point is. I'm looking at the Gulf Coast in Florida, the West Coast, and looking where is that breaking point? Because people, people were driven out of that area after Ian, there's now a fair amount of rebuilding going on there.
Yeah, what do you think, Ben?
We were talking about prior to COVID going to the shore and how much it costs to rent a beach house. And if you go now, my memory is, you know, it's double at least, sure, maybe more than in the past. This is a signal that, you know, there's more demand, not less demand,
right,
in some of these areas. And these smaller houses are being replaced by larger ones. Part of this process may be related to Airbnb and other share economy stuff where people are renting these places. You have access to more of them than in the past. Some cities like Venice, so we're not the only place dealing with sea level rise, there have been huge changes in the population that lives there. Most of the property in Venice now is tourists coming through, right? So, I mean, I think also you can expect...
It can support a certain type of economy, but not sort of an everyday economy that we might associate with like year-round residents.
Right, and so these nice houses, some people own them, they live there all the time, but a lot of them are people renting them out for a week.
Yeah. And that economy keeps churning. I want to... put the question of the day out for our listeners. Should taxpayer money go to rebuilding and protecting the shore? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, keep those comments coming in the live chat. We do have a caller and I want to bring them in. We have Lynn from Pennsylvania who has friends and family who own property at the Jersey Shore and in North Carolina. Lynn, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I just wanted to share that all my family members who own or have owned beach property over the last 7 decades in New Jersey, North Carolina, and Oregon, it's not beachfront in Oregon, because Oregon years ago had the foresight to say the beach should be available to all citizens, and so they've limited where development can be at quite a distance from the shoreline. And I think that's a model that we on the East Coast need to learn from. I'd rather see tax dollars, sad as it would be, and my relatives agree, used under eminent domain law to take property back into public space, rather than year after year spend far much more money in the long run to constantly rebuild and rebuild. Yeah. And there's a way to do this and still protect the businesses that thrive for the people from all over the country that want to have a vacation time at the shore.
Yeah.
Thank you so much,
Lynn. And Gil, you wanted to comment in response to Lynn's
There was
thoughts.
A proposal after the 1962 Ash Wednesday storm in New Jersey. The governor made it. And it was backed by the feds at that time to pull back the first couple rows of homes along the New Jersey coast. And at that time, there was still a fair amount of space that wasn't developed along the oceanfront in New Jersey. it never went anywhere. It was defeated by the politicians in Trenton.
Oh, sorry, on that point, though, mm-hmm. I thought I read that actually those frontline homes are not the ones at greatest risk. It's the Back Bay homes. So if you pull back from the coastline, I was just curious how much that would even help.
Well, it depends from state to state and the geography of the coastline. I mean, it's true in Sandy that most of the damage was along the back bays, on the back sides of the barrier islands, and then on the towns across the bay, across Barnegat Bay, along the bayside. That had to do with the nature of Sandy. It took a hard turn into the coast. Its path was blocked from going up the coast, and the bay was already full of water, and the storm winds turned south, and they blew all that water up the coast into those homes, and that caused all that damage.
Yeah, I want to bring in another caller. We have Michelle from Surf City, Long Beach Island on the line. It's nice to hear from somebody living on the beach. Michelle, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment was about the flood insurance and the resilience and people paying for their own repairs. The flood insurance only will cover your first floor, which at this point in time, there's very few structures that aren't 14 feet in the air. We have always had flood insurance for our home, and we have never gotten a payment. Not 62, there was no flood insurance. Sandy, there was no flood insurance. October 91, there was no flood insurance. There was no recomp, nothing. I've been flooded 15 times in the basement of my home, and nobody covers anything below that first floor.
And so,
this year, the rates went up over $1,000 for me at 14 feet in the air. And what I'm paying for is, if you'll look at the statistics, places in where rivers are flood way more frequently and consistently than beaches, to me, beach communities. So I got rid of flood insurance because, A, it doesn't pay for anything, and there's no point in me paying for something that's not going to give me something back.
Yeah, and why do you keep...
We've always had to repair ourselves, always, all through. I mean, I'm fourth generation. My husband's family's sixth generation. We live here.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much, Michelle. Yeah. Gil, you wanted to...
Flood insurance doesn't cover basements. The other point I would make is that I've looked at this very closely. If you look historically at all the spending from the flood insurance program, 75% of the spending over time, billions and billions and billions of dollars, has gone to coastal communities, not to river communities, as the caller was mentioning. Yes, there are places along the river. The Passaic Valley in New Jersey is a good example. That flood, the Mississippi Valley, is another good example. But most of the spending for the program is at the coast.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about who gets sort of left behind here, because we talked about, we had Mayor Tim Carney on, and their town is less than 900 people, 3,000 homes, though, less than 900 full-time residents. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, as the expenses rise, right, as, mm-hmm. you know, insurers pull out or raise the prices for premiums, who gets left with nothing?
Right. A lot of these conversations are recognizing, like following price increases with flood insurance, that higher income folks can afford to make those payments. Lower income folks have a harder time. And you'll have cases where people just bought a house and they got their finances in the right spot, then prices change and they can't afford it anymore. People maybe who've lived in the community a long time and they're retired and they're on a fixed income and they can't pay. So I certainly think that there's sort of a couple of things we need with insurance. One is that the prices should reflect the risk that people are taking on. If it's priced too low, this creates concerns that they're not going to do things to adapt, but also that there's an affordability issue, and we need to make sure that people are able to buy insurance, because we want to make sure people have insurance. There are ways that we've actually never used to try to target insurance vouchers and things like that to make sure that people who are retired or on low incomes can afford to buy insurance that's focused on an individual's ability to pay, not on, subsidizing a structure that might be owned by a rich person or might be owned by a poor person.
Okay, so a couple minutes left. And in those 2 minutes, can we fix this, Gil Gall? Like, what's the prescription for the next...
2 minutes, Gil.
Yeah, I've got 2 minutes to fix it.
Well, great. Look, great. We've seen these really dire projections for 2050 and 2100 for all of these communities. And is there a scenario, is there something we could do to kind of maintain the status quo along the shore while keeping these communities accessible to a large group of people? Or is that just out the window, impossible at this point?
I don't know. I'm not expert enough in climate to be able to tell you that we can fix it. I mean, there's this term that everybody uses called resilience, right? And we mentioned elevating houses. That's, I guess, one form of resilience. That'll buy you time. The water will flow under the house. As you mentioned, though, however, it will continue to do damage to the infrastructure. Other than pulling back in a thoughtful, slow way, or in the case of a place like Rodanthe on the Outer Banks where the houses are falling in a lot, pulling back quickly and doing a managed retreat, I'm not sure. Because 30, 50 years, the end of this century, the water's coming.
Yeah.
And that water will dramatically change what the geography looks like.
Yeah. If you could and, I'm sorry, Ben, did you want to add to that?
Oh, I think in particular, we have to build differently in different places, but also to build differently. And the two most important times to do that is the first time, when you're building the home in the first place, building with the future in mind instead of the past. And then if the home's damaged heavily and we have to repair it, that's a really crucial time. We need people to be thinking about if they're experiencing a flood on the Jersey Shore, are they going to be ready for the next one? And building differently than the past is important here.
That's the prescription right there.
I feel a little bit more ready after today's conversation. Not totally prepared, but we're getting there. Thank you so much. This was enlightening, though. Ben Collier is an associate professor of risk management and insurance at Temple University's Fox School of Business. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And Gil Gall is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and the author of The Geography of Risk. Gil, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Definitely enlightening conversation. And thanks to everybody who called in and commented. Thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Diana Martinez, and Tina Calliquet engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you again tomorrow.